Thanks for listening to The Kick-Ass Life with David Wood. Stay connected on Facebook, / The Kick-Ass Life, on Twitter, at The Kick-Ass Life, and, of course, at thekickasslife.com.
Hi, this is Dr. Joe Vitale, author of Attract Money Now. You're listening to The Kick-Ass Life Show with David Wood.
Life better?
This is the Kick-Ass Life Podcast with David Wood.
So hi everyone and welcome to the show. I'm really, really so happy you're here, and I'm sitting on the 32nd floor of my hotel, which is a right downtown Sydney. And as I'm looking out of my window right now, I see the Sydney Harbour Bridge in its all its splendor, which of course is located a matter of a few thousand meters from the Sydney Opera House. And just like sort of share where I'm at. I'm having a great, great trip in Australia. Two events down, one to go. I'll be heading to the office soon to finalize the event coming up, which is going to be in the Hunter Valley wine region. It's going to be stunning. So we leave for the Hunter Valley tomorrow. But you can hear my voice is a little raspy, and that's a combination of my work and long evenings and nights enjoying and getting to know and meeting beautiful people really sort of squeezing the juice out of every moment. And yesterday was a good example of that because, you know, we flew down from Perth, which is, it's quite a variance in time zones. And, it's a long day at the end of the day. And when we got here, it would have been very, very easy just to put on the pair of slippers, make a cup of tea, and hang out. And it was really kind of a little bit of a supreme effort just to sort of get going. But we did, and we ended up going to a revolving restaurant on the 42nd floor of a building, of the Australia building, which is very, very close to here. And the food was impeccable. And every hour, the restaurant would spin or turn gently, it was very, very slowly, of course. It took one full hour to turn completely. And so, you've got all the sights of Sydney and the lights and it's fascinating sort of downtown. I've always said that there's something about a downtown scape that can be so, so, so attractive. So, I suppose the theme of this whole trip has really been that openness again from a kick-ass life is the ability to collect people and meet and have rich, authentic conversations where, in a matter of minutes, but certainly in a small amount of time, there really is a deep connection. And I think it's really something that everyone who's a practitioner of a kick-ass life, and certainly those of you that have been to my programs where I teach the art of connection, it's something that really is a muscle that we all need to build more. And I teach my students, the greatest opening line in mankind, you may want to write this one down. I'll wait for you. Grab a pen quick. Here you go. Ready? Hello. Or as I like to say, hello. Excuse my voice here. Just hello and a smile. And if someone's open and receptive, the conversation's going to start from there. And interestingly, Jen and I flew down from Perth in different parts of the plane. And she sat next to a guy called Peter. And by the time I met up with her at the end of the flight, I went and she introduced me to this guy. And she really said, I feel like I've really met a real friend, someone that I'm going to get to know interesting. He's an electrical engineer, and you know, he's working away from his kids 2 weeks of every sort of 2 weeks working and 1 week at home. Just sort of, and she knew his whole life story, and that again is the sort of the art of a kick-ass life practitioner, is, you know, really that beautiful collection of people, and all types of people who necessarily you wouldn't design to say, oh, this is kind of what my friend looks like, because I mean, I think if we look at our closest friends, there isn't a pattern. I mean, typically we do attract who we are, though. So if we're negative, we will attract quite a few negative people. If we're really supremely positive and upbeat, and you know, we dream a lot and set goals and go for things in life, we will find our closest friends are similar. So that's why it's so important to have that. And this leads it beautifully into my guest today, because my guest, as I'm going to describe when I open the show with him, is someone I sat next to on a plane, which is, you know, he looked like an actor. And he towers over, I think he's 6'5 or 6'6. I'm 6'3. Long hair, and he has this real presence about him. And this guy was born in 1946. And he was a guy that has had a very, very interesting career as an American criminal defense attorney. And I've always been fascinated by this whole idea of defense, you know, of defending someone's rights, even if you know they are guilty. How do you do that? But then as we started talking, he started telling me his story, and he let me know that he was the defender of a number of high-profile cases, including the serial killer Ted Bundy. And that happened when he was a young guy. You'll hear about that on the show, because I'm going to ask him a lot of questions about that. But, you know, the serial killer who you know, really, when you think of a sociopath, you think of a serial killer, and you think of this guy, my guest, being a young man and having to defend him and spend time with him locked in cells with this guy, you know, think of Silence of the Lambs, you know, and that kind of sociopath, it's mind-boggling. But it wasn't just one high-profile case. My guest also, and this is why I asked him to come on the show, because after he spoke to me about Ted Bundy and told me that whole story, which was fascinating, you're going to be fascinated by it. He told me that he also was a defender of Colton Harris Moore, who's known as the Barefoot Bandit. And for some of you in different countries, you may not know this story, but it's a wonderful story of a young man who grew up in a bad home. And, you know, he ended up going on the run from the police for 2.5 years, stealing exotic planes and cars, and, you know, and just this really intelligent kid. And as this, as my guest talked about him, I could see that he has a love affair for this kid, and really there was something about defending him that was just right. And there were so many other high-profile cases that this guy has had over his career. And the latest, in March of 2012, he took on a case of Staff Sergeant Robert Bates. Now, this is the soldier accused of murdering 18 Afghan citizens, mostly women and children. The incident's known as the Kandahar Massacres. And, you know, the game of fascinating that this guy, here he is in a central piece in one of the most talked about cases in the entire world right now. And that's when I met him. I was flying into Kansas, and he was flying into Leavenworth Prison, and we sat next to each other. And it was just the most fascinating story he has. So sit in with me as I, another part to this. Really listen in to the whole show. You know, make sure that you listen in to his motives, because I think there's a lot of beauty in what he's bringing into the world in many, many ways. There's something very behind all of this. You know, the fact that he's defending these people are, in many cases, are obviously guilty. And I'm not saying that's the case for this staff sergeant, because he hasn't been found guilty at all. But I do want you to listen in and think about the world as it is, where people like this guy doesn't exist, and what he really stands for. So sitting as I sit down and have a chat with a guy that really I know is going to become a friend of mine, and we've really enjoyed our company now that we've chatted a number of times. His name's John Henry Brown.
So as I go through life, I'm constantly bumping into the most fascinating people. And my guest tonight is one of those people. When I met him, I thought he was a movie star, actually. I was sitting next to him on a plane. I was flying into Kansas City, and he was flying into Kansas City, obviously sitting next to me. And I thought there was this wonderful presence about him. There was this wonderful energy, and he has these long, long locks and a very, very tall, gracious man, and this wonderful voice. It's like a great storytelling voice. And fortunately, we got to chat, and fortunately, our paths crossed. And I'm very, very honored to have you on the call. So welcome to the call, John Henry Brown.
Well, thank you. It's great to be here.
Now, you have such a fascinating story. You're known as the dynamic defender by some. I read an article recently in a Seattle magazine where you were called John Henry Effin Brown. You have many, many titles. I'm told, and I've read, and I've seen that in court, your peers have tremendous respect and think you're this wonderful and gracious human being and funny and witty until you're in court, and then you have this absolute ability to do things in court that many can't. But I want to ask you a question. You know, take me back. You were the defender of the likes of Ted Bundy, the serial killer, when you were just a young man. And you were the defender of Colton Harris Moore, who's known as the Barefoot Bandit, a young boy who'd committed 67 crimes. And recently, Staff Sergeant Robert Bales, who's accused of 16 or 17 murders. And so you've had this incredible array of cases that are really renowned throughout the world. And I want to take you back to when you were a young man and you were doing work on the prison systems. You were going to reform the prison systems. And to do that, you decided the best way was to become an inmate. And you went into jail as under the guise of a pedophile. Take me back to that moment. And what was that like?
Well, it was very scary. Well, it was my idea, my bright idea that, you know, I hadn't visualized myself working for the government, basically, and I ended up having this job working for the government and working for the governor of the state of Washington, who at the time was a very progressive man and great man. He's still alive, actually, Dan Evans, and he wanted to try and make the prison systems more humane and more responsible to the needs of the prisoners, and wanted to institute rules so the prisoners were not treated arbitrarily and so on and so forth. And I was hired. I had some expertise in that because when I was in law school, I started a prison legal services program, which was actually the first one in the country, with a friend of mine. And so anyway, I ended up working, getting hired by Governor Evans, and my job was to try to reform the prison system in Washington State. And I had a bright idea. Well, myself and a few others should go into the prison system as prisoners and experience what it's like for, I think it was either a week or 10 days. I think it was 10 days. And we got a grant to do that. And three of us went in. The other two that went in with me were discovered quite quickly because they were well known in Washington State. One was actually the head of the parole board, who was a great person. And the other was an assistant attorney general who was very well known. And I had just moved here, so nobody knew me. So I made it through the whole 10 days as a sex offender, as you say. And it was very enlightening. It was very scary. You know, if you've never heard a metal prison door slam shut, you can't really relate to the whole situation. It's a sound that you just never forget, and it's a sound I hear every day almost in my life still. So, you know, I was losing my freedom. I was going into a maximum security prison as a sex offender, which is the lowest of the lowest in the prison system.
I was going to ask you about that, because obviously, you know, sex offenders get killed, they get beaten, they get, you know, I mean, the other inmates tend to want to harm them. Even the guards, I think, have some bent against that. Was that choosing to be that? Was it because you wanted to experience the very worst you could experience, or why a pedophile? Why not just a bank robber or something else?
I think I did want to experience wanted to experience the worst of the prison system, knowing I would be frowned upon by everybody in the system. At the same time, this is a maximum security prison, so I had a cell to myself when I was in the cell, and so I wasn't really worried about getting jumped when I was in the cell. But when I was out on the in the yard and in other common areas, I definitely was concerned.
So something happened in there, though, and obviously I read your story about, you know, the strip search when you first go in, and, you know, being doused down with lye and you know, cavity searches and all these kind of indignities. So you go through all of that. But when you're in there, you start looking at these guys, and there's men in there that kind of don't know why they're in there or what to do about it, and there's nothing going on for them. And that kind of changed the course of your life a little bit, didn't it?
Well, actually, excuse me, David, you're referring to the first time I was in jail, which was when I was in college. I was in a rock and roll band that was quite famous in Colorado, actually, and we played with Jimi Hendrix and the Doors. When the big bands came to Denver, we would open for them, and our band was very successful, and I was also very active in politics, and I was a member of SNCC and CORE and SDS, and so I was kind of the scourge of Denver as far as the police were concerned, and I was arrested by the police when I was in the band in Denver and ended up going to jail for something I didn't do. They were just harassing me, and that was literally turned my life around, that experience, where I actually went to jail for real. They claimed I wrote a bad check or something. It was hilarious because the narcotics squad arrested me, not the check squad. And that was the experience where I knew I'd get out for a variety of reasons. My band managers were very well-known in Denver and very successful, and I had a friend at the time who was very politically active, and I knew with traditional politics, and I knew I'd get out of jail. But for 3 days, I spent just talking to these people who were in the big cell in Denver. Most were black and most were Hispanic, and none of them knew why they were there, and that was what made me decide to go to law school rather than pursue my music career, that experience. So that was different than the artificial going to the maximum security prison, which was, 6 years later, I think.
And that's really, it's always fascinated me when someone, you know, chooses to be a defender, especially when there's cases where you would think that the person is, you know, obviously either self-confessed, and I'll talk about, let's move right along to the 70s, where you're suddenly, you're a young guy, you're still wet behind the ears, as you described to me on the plane as we were chatting, and one of your first big cases is with the serial killer, Ted Bundy. Can you take me back to that moment? How did that all come about?
Well, yeah, that was very strange, and actually I've put together some of it when I was, just in the last year, some of it. I've kind of compartmentalized that whole part of my life because it was so difficult. Representing, you know, it will be known soon. It's already speculated right now, but it'll be known when my book comes out that, you know, Ted Bundy will be considered the most prolific serial murderer in the history of mankind, basically. He confessed to me that he killed over 100 individuals, and
I've got to say that only to you, though, right? I mean, you're the only person he confessed to with that particular, because I mean they thought it was 40, right? And there was an additional 60 that he admitted to you to have killed.
Well, there were a couple of times when he sarcastically said to cops who were interviewing him that they'd say something like, well, you've killed 30 people or 40 people, and he'd say, and he said on a couple of occasions, you better add a digit to that,
right?
So he kind of implied to others, but never really went through the details, which I really didn't want to hear, but at one point in my representation of him, he did. And he also gave me a release of the attorney-client privilege so I could write about my relationship with him. And I've never done that for almost 40 years now, and I just started doing it and putting things together and realizing that Ted really seemed to have chosen me. I mean, we were almost exactly the same age. We were only apart by 1 month. He seemed to know, he knew where I lived. He knew what kind of women I went out with. He knew what kind of cars I drove. He knew, where I bought my clothes. I think I might have told you that one of the eerie things, and it was actually an opening line in my book, and it's going to be in the beginning of the book, but not necessarily the opening line, and that is, what do you do when you're 29 years old and you're in a maximum security jail cell with Ted Bundy, and you're on your way out, and he turns to you and says, "The reason you've been my lawyer so long is because we're so much alike."
Yeah. That was one of the reasons. You told me that on the plane, and that haunted me. That haunted me. And I told that story on Facebook. I told the story to so many people. I said, I just want him on the show. I want to talk to him and get into this a little bit more. Because what was that like to turn around with this guy? And I think of Hannibal Lecter, from Silence of the Lambs. And here you are, this young kid. And you'd lost a girlfriend through a murder, didn't you, when you were younger?
I did. And I think I just kind of recently put that in perspective too, because I think that affected me a lot more than I let. I think I lived in denial about that and for years. That's kind of a long story, but I mean, after she was murdered, I became very anti life basically, and was in favor of the death penalty for the first time in my life. And then I had this very powerful dream where she came to me and said that, don't honor my life by believing in something I would never believe in. So then I became the opposite, which was an advocate for opposing the death penalty every time I could. And then, I knew that Ted had killed individuals. She was killed in Berkeley, California, when I was in Washington, D.C., going to law school, and the crime has never been solved. And I do know that Ted was active killing people in California around that time, but I never considered that there'd be any connection, and I still don't believe there's a connection. But it's definitely a strange circumstance. And going back to the comment that Ted made to me, when he said we're so much alike, he later explained to me, years later when I was with him in Miami, after his second escape from custody, and he was on trial for the death penalty in Florida, and he had turned down a plea bargain that I had arranged for him to save his life. And that's when he told me all the details about lots of things. And I asked him, I said, "Well, why did you say that to me once about being so much alike?" Because it really, obviously offended me, because he now had told me, that he was a mass murderer. And he told me, and that one circumstance that, John, I want to be a good person, I'm just not, which, by the way, for a sociopath is very unusual. Most sociopaths never admit that they're evil, and Ted knew he was evil. And he said, "Well, I made that comment to you because if I hadn't gone down," I actually think he used the words dark side, "if I hadn't gone down the dark side, I wanted to do what you did." And I think he had this vision of my lifestyle, living in a waterfront house and driving nice cars and dating models and all that sort of stuff that, which, of course, he didn't know. I was very miserable during those days, doing a lot of drugs and other things. But, his vision of what he thought I was all about is what he wanted to be if he hadn't gone down the dark side.
I should say, just so people who haven't seen you, you're 6'6", I think, and you're a handsome guy. You're 65 now, I think, or 64, but you really have a striking pose. So I can imagine that you represent for a lot of guys that sort of that appearance of confidence. Anyway, I'm not going to say I don't know you well enough yet, but so Ted Bundy, you're in a cell with him, you're defending him, you're new at this, what's going on? I mean, how do you go at home at night? And I mean, how do you become a defender of someone who is obviously, or maybe he hadn't mentioned to you at that point, but, you know, is confessing that he is a murderer? What happens inside you? What was the conflict early on?
Well, you know, I think this has been my path. I mean, and I don't think it's easy. I mean, I know we're probably not supposed to swear on your poll.
You can swear. Swear ahead. Go ahead.
But, you know, I was being interviewed by the New York Times for a profile they did on me recently, actually. And I'm kind of humbled by all of that attention that I've been getting recently. But anyway, the New York Times was interviewing me for a profile that they did. And the guy asked me why I did what I did. And I said, it's, you know, my fucking path. And he said, that's not very romantic. And I said, no, it's not. And this is a very, very difficult job, and I don't recommend this job for a lot of people. I go to law schools and give talks, and I gave a talk to the Seattle Rotary this last week and told them, you know, I don't recommend this job to many people. And it really, to do it and do it well and stay balanced, it really has to be your path, and I think it's what I'm supposed to do. This is what I'm supposed to do. And so, you know, the irony, when I was representing Ted Bundy, I was also representing battered women. And I actually established law nationally that protected battered women, women who were abused by their husbands and ended up killing them. And in my opinion, should be given a medal rather than jail. And I established law for battered women that has become the law. And so it was a very strange life, to say the least. I mean, on one hand, you're representing mass murder of women. On the other hand, you're representing women for women's causes. I was asked to do that by the Northwest Women's Law Center. So, you know, it's just basically standing between government and individuals, regardless of who those individuals are.
Right. And obviously you've attracted a lot of very high profile cases, and we'll go into that in a minute. But I want to sort of put a wrap around Ted for a minute, because, you know, again, for a sociopath who's killed, and again, we're talking possibly 100 women, and you're working with this guy and you're having to go home each night. And I there was a story, and I believe you told me this on the plane, where, you know, he had asked you a question about the death penalty. Where was the death penalty? You know, which states was the death penalty in? And then he escaped from jail and actually went and committed more murders in that particular state. Is that right?
Yes.
One of the
things about Ted that's so interesting, and I think will play out in the book more too, is, you know, it's amazing the authorities allowed him to escape the first time, and then it's almost beyond belief that they allowed him to escape the second time. And the story of his second escape is quite interesting, actually, in some ways quite funny, actually. But in between the first and second escape, and after the first escape, I had gone to Aspen, Colorado, where I had been in Aspen a lot in college, because my band, the band I was in, used to play in Aspen quite often. So I knew Aspen really well, and he was in this jail after his first escape in the Pitkin County Jail in Aspen, which is an old building, a beautiful building, and it has a sign on the front that says, Doc Holliday slept here, which is true, by the way. But Ted was in there, and I came to visit him after they apprehended him the first time. And he had just been charged with the death penalty in Colorado. And during that conversation I had with him, he said something that, at the time, of course, I didn't think there was any importance to it, because who knew he was going to escape a second time, right? And he said, well, where would a person go in the United States where they would actually get the death penalty? And I said to him, Texas or Florida, because their statutes had just been upheld by the Supreme Court. And, of course, when he escaped the second time, he originally went to Chicago and Ann Arbor, Michigan, where he could have disappeared easily in the milieu of those two large places. And instead, he goes to Tallahassee, Florida, and that's where he's finally apprehended and commits murders there.
That's crazy. So as you're writing this book, I can feel that it must be quite cathartic for you. And there's this, I know it's probably going to be out in the next 7 months, and that you have someone helping you with that process right now. And I can almost hear in your voice that there's lessons that you learned from each one of these steps you've taken. And obviously Ted must have had quite an impact on you as a young lawyer. Is there, when you look back on that, are there any lessons you take out of that experience right now that you realize have played out in your life? Or
yeah, I think I've minimized and utilized denial a great deal to kind of get through it all for the last 35 years or so, and focusing, you know. So I really believe that my job is just nothing more than service work. You know, I provide a service to people that happens to be, in some instances, literally saving their lives, certainly protecting their freedom. And so, you know, somebody asked me once, it was really interesting, I was on a talk show one time, and somebody, and I think you'll relate to this well, probably, and somebody asked me in a talk show one time what distinguished people like Ted Bundy from the rest of us. And I actually spontaneously said, and I had never thought of it before, but I said on the talk show, the total absence of any notion that we are somehow all connected.
Mm-hmm.
And I certainly have the belief that we are certainly all connected. And I think that's been a big problem in our society right now. I mean, don't realize that the kids that get killed in Afghanistan are just like our kids. But in any event, Ted, and so, you know, there was a total absence of any notion that Ted was connected to any other person. And I see that in other clients that I've helped, and they're very difficult people to be around. You know, if they're a true sociopath, there's no way you can get through to them and get them to see that. But at the same time, I can increase my status on the humanity meter, I think, by being of service to people who no one wants to help.
Right. And I really get that from you, because one of the things when we were on the plane, another story, I remember you were flying into Fort Leavenworth Star Sergeant Robert Bales, and we'll talk about him in a minute. But you told me the story about the Barefoot Bandit, which a lot of people may not know the story, but he was accused of 67 crimes, and his name was Colton Harris Moore, this young kid. And as you told me his story, what came across to me, and I could have read it wrong, I mean, John, you and I haven't spoken about this, but was your deep, kind of almost like a fatherly love for this kid, knowing that he was a good kid who kind of had maybe a rough time at home, and he went off and did this stuff. But inside of him, you really saw someone really beautiful, and there was something else in play there. Was I right? I mean, did I pick up the right sort of stuff that you were sharing?
Oh yeah, I think absolutely. That's very profound of you, actually. But you know, Colton is one of the more interesting individuals I've ever met. He's only 21 right now, and he has. You know, I asked him, you know, the story of Colton Harris Moore, which is, there's two books out about him now, and there's going to be a movie. 20th Century Fox is making a movie about Colton, and the screenwriter is Dustin Lance Black, who won the Academy Award for Milk, which was a fabulous movie.
Oh, yeah, that's a great movie.
And so the screenwriter's an Academy Award-winning person, and the director is Robert Zemeckis, who's an Academy Award-winning guy. So this is going to be a good movie, but it's just, he's such an interesting fellow. The first time, I thought that volunteering, people asked me to help Colton while he was still running away from, you know, he was taking airplanes and flying all over the world, and he'd never flown in a plane in his whole life. He kind of
taught himself how to fly. He was so bright, he taught himself how to fly, right?
When he was 16 and 17. And, you know, and they couldn't catch him. Homeland Security couldn't catch him. The FBI couldn't catch him.
Was it two and a half years he was on the run?
Yes. And he was finally caught in the Bahamas, and believe it or not. But one of the things I learned about him early on, and this is what I'm, and so I thought it was going to take me 50 hours of my free time to represent him. You know, I knew I wasn't going to get paid, and I knew the government would let me get any of the money that was generated from the movie, because the government doesn't like me, and Colton never wanted to make any money. He was very much against it, which is very interesting. And so the money that was generated for the movie, by the way, went to all the victims. But I asked Colton, I knew that he had been in a halfway house, which is basically an apartment building, a nice apartment building, actually, for juvenile offenders. He had been sent to prison for a bunch of petty things. You know, he was raised in a trailer in the middle of the woods by an alcoholic mother who was brain dead. And he was in this juvenile home. He was only 16, and he escaped from that home. And I asked him why he escaped, and he said that they were... He wanted to go back to the maximum security prison for juveniles, which is like a fortress prison. It's almost like Fort Leavenworth. And he wanted to go from this kind of cushy environment to this maximum security prison. And I said, why? Nobody in their right mind would want to go from the apartment complex back to the maximum security prison. Why would you do that? And he said, because at the halfway house, they were trying to change who I was. And I thought that was just an amazing answer. I mean, he, you know, at the time when I was talking to him, he was only 18. But when he had that notion that he knew who he was and he didn't want anybody to change that, he was only 16.
Right.
And then I asked him sometime about writing a book and about his story, because it's so interesting. I mean, it's really going to be an interesting...
Well, you look at the movie Catch Me If You Can, which was based on a true story. I mean, that was a phenomenon. I've seen that movie, I think, three times. And what I find so fascinating about it was that it was based in some level of truth. And I think you told me on the plane that this eclipses that movie by tenfold, right?
Well, yeah. Actually, Mr. Abingale, who is the subject of that movie, the Catch Me If You Can was actually fictionalized. It wasn't all true. They're not going to have to fictionalize anything about Colton's story. Matter of fact, the dilemma for the screenwriter in Colton's situation is, you know, how are you going to turn some of the things he's done into, you know, 130 pages, which is what a screenplay is, only 130 or 40 pages. But, you know, Colton's did just, and Colton had to, definitely had the hand of God on his shoulder the whole time. I mean, you know, when you take an airplane, you've never even been on an airplane, and you fly the airplane through the Cascades on a no-fly day in November when there's whiteouts, and the plane descends from 14,000 feet to 5,000 feet, and you can't see where you're going, and you know that Mount Rainier is on your right, and it's 14,000 feet, and you know Mount Baker's on your left, and it's 14,000 feet, and you've never flown the plane before, and then you make it. It's pretty amazing. His story is just phenomenal. But I asked him, you know, early on if, you know, he wanted to write a book or wanted somebody to write a book about it, and he said no. And I said, well, why? He said, because if I tell my story, then it won't be my story anymore.
Mm.
You know, it's almost like if you look in the mirror, your soul gets taken or something. But the bottom line on that is I thought it was going to take 50 hours of work, and it ended up taking 500 hours of work. I had to hire another lawyer to take up the slack. But we were able to do something which I never thought was possible, and we consolidated. It's about 70 crimes, actually, David. 70 crimes in 6 different states and 2 different countries into 2 cases, which means we had to get all these people to agree from all over the country. And I never thought we could do it, and we did do it. And he actually will be out of custody when he's 25. He's 21 now. And so it really was a miraculous result. And there's a funny... Well, not funny. There's a profound part of this that just happened, in that he is now being mentored by a vice president of Boeing, who is one of the chief vice presidents in charge of the 737 division of Boeing, which is the biggest division of Boeing, who is taking one weekend out of his life every month, and going down and mentoring Colton Harris more. And there's some other people that are doing the same. So it's one of those things where the judge who sentenced Colton called him a triumph of the human spirit, which I don't hear that much with my clients.
I got goosebumps when you said that. You know, what I love about this, and I think that for anyone who doesn't know what you do, again, when I sat next to you, I mean, I didn't know what you did, and I just knew that you were a beautiful person, and it really sort of oozes out of you. But there was something about this understanding this story, like 500 free hours with no possibility of recouping that, really, as far as, you know, you can't write a book or you couldn't. And there's all these different things that at the time, these restrictions. Why? Because you've done it a lot and you're doing it right now. You're defending someone for free. What is all this free stuff? Why do you keep doing it?
I don't know. You know, I don't really know. I mean, it's very difficult. I mean, you know, the irony and the funny thing is that people think I'm wealthy, which is really not the case. Because, you know, if you figure doing Colton's case has cost 500 hours of my time and my staff's time, and now I'm doing Robert Bales and pretty much financing it myself. And it's, you know, the biggest case in the world right now, really. And I'm fighting the government and it's a very difficult fight to fight the government. And I'm just trying to finance it myself through my other cases and raise a little money here and there, but that hasn't gone very well.
People who want to help you can do it, though. They can give money towards your, if they wanted to help, right?
You know, to show you what a bad businessman, there's a website for Sergeant Bales that's, if you just Google Sergeant Bales, the website will come out where people can make donations. But, you know, my whole thing about Sergeant Bales is, and I, you know, he's charged with such horrific crimes. You know, Sergeant Bales is charged with massacring 16 Afghan citizens, many of whom are women and children. And it's hard to imagine anything more horrific than that. And yet, of course, I went and met with him and found out that there's this, he's a very sympathetic person in many ways, and I can't talk a lot about what I know, and actually some of it is still classified as top secret, and the government, you know, I refuse to do a background check with the government, which is another whole story. But in any event, you know, if you assume for the moment that Sergeant Bales was responsible for something, you know, we created him, and I've really gotten to become an extremely vocal against the war. And
well, isn't it true, John, aren't you putting sort of the war on Iraq and the war on Afghanistan, sort of putting that on trial to say, look, when we put these guys into that kind of situation and they go back and they do multiple times in these areas, that stuff happens? I mean, again, and nothing's been proven, and I get that, and I understand that he doesn't remember. Again, well, I know a little bit about this, I don't know much, and I don't want to cross any lines for you here. But really what you're saying, when you defend people, like whoever you're defending, there is another side. And it's very easy for us all to sit on this side of an argument, knowing as little as we do, and have judgment and start pointing fingers. Am I getting right what's going on there? Is this what's driving you a little bit?
Yeah, I think so. My father who's still alive, and he was just here last weekend, actually. He's 93, and he's all there, and he said, you know, I always had this, he used to call it the wounded bird. You know, when I was a kid, I'd bring on wounded birds and try to fix it. You know, that's his way of viewing what, and he wishes I'd do something else because my job is so hard, and it's really taxing in many ways, and it's not lucrative. But, you know, as I said before, I really think it's my path, I have a tendency to try to see the good in everyone, which is important for a defense lawyer. And at the same time, we can be foolish. I can be very foolish. And you know, this is just, you know, the reason, the only, I've given speeches at law schools, and I go to these law schools, and they're usually pretty well attended. The students come and listen to me speak. And I've taught before, but anyway, I go give talks, and I gave one recently to a prestigious law school, and there were 250 law students there, and I said, you know, the only reason to be a lawyer is to help people, and you know, you just don't hear many lawyers saying that, and I said, I paused, and I looked around the room, and I said, and has any one of your professors told you that while you're at law school? And they all shook their heads no, and all the professors walked out of the room, and I'll never be invited back there again. So I do believe it's just, you know, a service job, what what I do. It's a service job. Now, bales is different in that, you know, we a lot of us, soldiers I've met, I've met a lot of soldiers because of this. I become respect them. A lot of them have absolutely no idea why we're in Afghanistan. A lot of them know that you can't win that war. It's not winnable. And yet, you know, Sergeant Bales has gone around picking up body parts and putting them in bags of people he used to know. And, you know, this is his fourth deployment, and he didn't want to go back, but he's a good soldier, so he did. And the military knew he had a head injury from a previous deployment. They knew he had post-traumatic stress disorder, and they sent him back anyway. And, you know, if you put on top of that the costs of this war, I mean, I gave a speech to the Rotary this week, and I told you, and I finally got the figure, and I got it from the Wall Street Journal, and the war in Iraq and Afghanistan has cost us about $5 trillion, which is half of our national debt. And yet, during our presidential campaign that's going on right now, neither side talks about the war. It's like it doesn't exist. And, you know, one of Al-Qaeda's goals was to destroy our economy. And look what's happened.
So I want to just, because we don't have too much longer in the show, but I really want to sort of dig around a little bit. You know, the show's called The Kick-Ass Life, and I'm going to ask you in a moment what you think that means for you.
I love that title.
Thank you. But there's something about, I always think, you know, environment is stronger than willpower. You've dealt with, and through your career, some of the most hardened and toxic killers and people who have, obviously, when we come even down to the Barefoot Bandit, you know, a really good kid who grew up in some unfortunate circumstances. And because of the environment, and I that's what I hear. Maybe I'm putting words in your mouth, and I don't want to put words in your mouth. But it would seem to me that the environment plays such a huge role, and the same with Sergeant Bales, the environment, again, playing this massive role on the choices. And these people have chosen to cross the line, chosen to kill, or chosen to commit horrific crimes, or just the kid, you know, really, that they weren't terrible crimes. They were just, it was like a, you know, modern day Bonnie and Clyde type of situation. But do you think that everyone is really, there is good in everyone, and that good, when someone turns left instead of right, when they cross that line into crime or cross that line into the most horrific crimes, is it, in your experience, when you've got to know these stories, is it typically environmental and what's happened to them as kids or whatever, or is it mental? Is it something where they really are more deranged, or what do you think causes this exodus to the let's call it the dark side?
Well, I think the majority of the people who go down the dark side, it is environmental, but I also think and believe that there are people who are just plain evil, and you know, and I think Ted Bundy was evil. Now, I think some of our leaders are evil. And so, I mean, I think, and I don't like to say that. I wish that I could say there's good in everyone, and I've seen good in everyone. But I've seen too many Ted Bundys. You know, Ted knew he was evil, which really put him aside from others, but he didn't necessarily make apologies about it. And his upbringing was somewhat normal, somewhat. I mean, you know, I think John Bradshaw used to say that 92% of American families are dysfunctional and the other 8% are liars. You know, I think there's something dysfunctional in every family. But I think environmentally, yeah, I mean, I just, you know, there's generations of black kids who, you know, haven't had a father you know, we now have more people incarcerated in the United States per capita than any country in the world and any country in the history of the world. Mm-hmm. We now have more people incarcerated. And I think that's just tragic. And so, you know, I to answer your question, I mean, I think that the majority of people who get in trouble with the law, it's environmental. And I think there's a small, thank God, a very small percentage of people that are just plain evil.
And so if you had a, I mean, if there was a message you could impart, because, you know, for someone like yourself who has to go in these prisons, like the day I met you, the next day you were, you know, you were hearing that door slam behind you again, and here you are sitting across the table with these guys and helping them through their own minefields. And again, I mean, I'm sure there's times, maybe a question I should ask you, has there been anyone that you've defended through your career where you kind of know, you know that they're full of it, they're full of crap and they're lying or whatever like that. And does it change? I mean, do you still have to, your job is to do a job and there's a way of doing your job, or is there a time where you say, screw it, I don't want to do this one. I don't want to help this guy because I just know it's all wrong. I mean, how do you deal with that?
Well, I mean, you're asking me, how do I represent people that I know are guilty? I mean, I get that question every day. And, you know, basically, you know, my job is to stand between people and government. I mean, I was just reading a book recently which had a great quote in it, and it's actually from Thomas Jefferson. And I mean, he's amazing quotes from that man. And it was, you know, when the government is afraid of people, we have freedom. When people are afraid of the government, we have tyranny. And I believe wholeheartedly that that's true. And I think that defense lawyers and criminal defense lawyers are so important to our system and to maintain our freedoms that I'm very proud to be one. But I also say that I think very few people can do what I do. You know, it's very difficult to know that a person is guilty and then go into courtroom and put the government to the test of proving that they're guilty. And in some instances, they're found not guilty. But I believe that's my role, and I really believe our democracy is at a perilous point right now. And unfortunately, my profession is a dying breed. I don't think there are going to be a lot of us in the future. I mean, it's just too hard a job. And you know, when I take on a case like Sergeant Bales, the government takes me on. So, you know, I become the bad boy.
Yeah, it becomes very personal. I can see that in how people write about you and all that kind of thing. So you have to, I was going to ask you about that. What brings you joy as you do this and you have all of this energy around you, which is dark? I mean, how do you step out of that and take your coat off at night and just sort of jump into the sort of the joy and the sort of the bright side of life? Is that a hard transition on a daily basis?
No, I first of all, I'm surrounded by a wonderful, loving family, and you met my wife. And I've been blessed. I mean, it took me a long time to find her, and I made a lot of mistakes before I did. But and my two boys are bring great joy to my life. My father, who's still around, gives joy to my life. But, you know, yeah, in the big picture, and it sounds a bit hokey, but I started my talk this week at the Rotary because, you know, we're talking about Rotarians, right, these conservative businessmen. And surprised they invited me. And there were a large number of them there. And I just started my talk by listing 14 or 15 names, and they didn't know what I was doing. And I listed names, and I paused, and I said, all those people I just told you about were innocent and who were in prison and going to spend the rest of their lives in prison or be executed if it wasn't for me. And they were all innocent, no question about it. And if it wasn't for someone like me, they would be in prison or dead. So, you know, I take a lot of pride in that, that I've made a difference in people's lives. You know, that's what I really want to do.
That really becomes evident. I say, when I spoke to you on the plane that day, what really struck me and why I wanted to get together and have you on the show was the love I saw in your eyes as you spoke about Colton, you know, this barefoot bandit and this deep kind of understanding of someone to be there and to help him through so that he can make a life for himself and that he to make sense of that for him. He's just a kid. I mean, he's wet behind the ears, 21, 18 when he started, I think, right? But I want to ask you one last question. What is it? The kick-ass life, what does that mean to you, to have a kick-ass life? What is that for you?
You know, it's making a difference. For me, it's making a difference in other people's lives. And you know, and I'm very blessed because I can see it. You know, I'm like an emergency room physician, you know, and I can see that I've actually saved people's lives, literally. So, you know, to me, that's a kick-ass life. I'm very interested in metaphysics. You know, my book actually has a tentative title. You'll probably get a kick out of it, and that is the tentative title, which sounds like it's going to keep, is Music, Metaphysics, and Murderers. And, you know, I already explained the music part from my rock and roll days, and then I've been very involved in spiritual things and for a while intensely involved. So, you know, my meditations, my my writing, my poetry, that all makes my life kick-ass. I must admit that I get joy out of the fact that the United States government is afraid of me. You know,
Big Bad John. That's why they they put the expletive in your name, John Henry F. M. Brown.
Yeah, right. So you know, I look forward to finishing this chapter in my life, actually, and you know, I think I'm getting to the point now. After Sergeant Bales, I'm gonna just concentrate on the more metaphysical things in my life and do some writing and participate in things like you do. So that's what I'd like to do next time.
Well, yeah, and I wish you so much luck with that. I know that our paths will cross many times, and I want to have you back. And I think it's funny, you know, again, when you gave me your card on the plane and I lost it, which I'm apt to do sometimes with business cards, and I think a week or two later, your wife actually attends one of my programs and comes up to me and hands me a newspaper with your picture on the front. And it stunned me at first because she didn't tell me she was your wife. But I'd mentioned something on Facebook about meeting you and the impact your story had on me. And it still has that impact on me because it would be so easy for me to judge and to sit in judgment. And you taught me a lot of very, very important lessons as I listened to you share your stories and your understandings of these. You know, again, if we go from a Ted Bundy to a Colton Harris. And I just want to thank you for what you do. And I want to thank you for being on the show.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. And, you know, and I'm a great believer in serendipity. And when my book comes out and you read it, you'll know why. And I think you and I connection is another example of that.
Well, thank you, John. And I say, we'll have you back on the show. Thanks so much.
Yeah, I think it's wonderful what you do too. Just keep it up.
Thanks.
So, like I said, just a fascinating, fascinating individual, and somebody I'm really looking forward to getting to know more. I think his book is going to be extraordinary, just because of the world he's seen and seeing into these minds. What surprises me quite often about the type of people that he's defended is these are ordinary people. It's our brothers and mothers and sisters and friends and people, our neighbors, people who on the outside appear to be extremely normal like everybody else. And I think about this sort of this barefoot bandit, you know, and just, you know, a young kid. And I was like that, you know. I was a kid that I stole cars. I didn't steal exotic cars. I wish I had. You know, and really, I was in jail and stole. And, you know, I remember, you know, I stole for a long time. When I first left home, I lived in the north of England in a place called Hull. And it's just a rough area on Anlaby Road. There were more murders on Anlaby Road than anywhere else in England at the time. And I worked in a tailor's store. I used to wear a three-piece suit to work, which I was on. I didn't own it. I was making payments on it. But I still didn't earn enough money to pay my rent and my bus and everything else. So I used to have to steal food every day. Yeah, so here I am walking into stores in my three-piece suit, shoplifting to eat. So, you know, when I hear these stories, I'm fascinated by, because I wonder the twists and turns of someone's life that brings them to a moment where they go over the top and they do the things that I think most people have thought about at least once. I mean, I think we've all had dark thoughts. And these guys have not just thought it, they've actually gone for it. So It was a fascinating meeting. I was really, really interesting that I lost his card. And then a week or two later, his wife shows up at one of my events. And she'd seen a post on Facebook. I talked about this story on Facebook. And she walks up to me and holding up the sort of newspaper, the local newspaper, and full page front photograph of this guy. She says, "You looking for this guy?" I said, "Yeah, who are you?" She said, "I'm his wife." "What?" Anyway, so that's synchronicity. That's why I knew right then that he would be on the show. And so, I hope you took some lessons out of that. And I will see you on the other side. I'm going to continue my trip through Australia. I'm really, really having so much fun, and obviously doing my work, which is also something I love to do, so it feels like fun all the time. But I'll see you on the other side. You have a good one.
That was kick-ass.